So you were about to tell me about going into the Army and your service in World War II, and you became a photographer.
Yeah, well, when I was, I mentioned I was working in Middletown for 6 months after I got out of the CC camps. And I knew nothing about airplanes, you know. I don't know why they hired me, but I had an interview and I put down my CC experiences and how I worked myself up and all that. I think that had something to do with it. And I applied for the job. There was about four or five fellas from Lansford that were working there. The two Melnick boys up the street here, Mike and Johnny. Petey McHugh, which he was a little older, and Bunker Boyle, and Joe Filipovich, and Speed Piaia, and they all had jobs there, and Joe Snishek. So I guess through them I found out that there was work down there, you know, so that's how I applied for the job. And they all stayed in the same house, in the same rooming place, you know, taking turns. Some were on night shift, some were on day shift. Well, I got the job. I got the job about May of 41, and I worked they put me in the engine department, where all I was doing was ripping down aircraft engine and cleaning them and, you know, and putting them on racks and stuff like that, and or polishing certain parts and all that. And after a while, I started to do other things around the hangar. The air depot was, as I look back now, it was something the government had been planning. They figured maybe there's going to be a confrontation in the future and all that. So they start putting these air depots up, civilian air depots all up through the United States to work on aircraft, you know, to rebuild the engines, to replace the skin on the things, and to the electrical components or whatever they had to do. And they had a number of them in the East here. They had one in Middletown. They had one up at Westover Field up near Boston. And they had one down in Florida, Homestead Field. And I know they had one out in California.
And these eventually became Air Force bases.
No, these were just depots, they called them, where they would bring airplanes in to have them repaired.
Military
planes, yeah. But at that time, they thought, well, this is a good way to start training people, in case we do have any problem, we'll have trained people, you know. So they started to train people, and they took me, and I didn't know anything about an airplane. I'd been up in small planes, but that was about it. And after I worked there for just about 6 or 7 months, and then first thing you know, it was December the 7th. I was on a night shift. In fact, I was with Dula Pekarik. We were out that Sunday night. We had a couple dates and all that. He had a car. He was working at the Mack plant at the time. He did get a job. His brother got him a job at the Mack plant in Allentown. So he did have a car. And we were out a little bit. And then first thing I know, it was December the 8th, Saturday. That was Sunday. And then the war was declared, you know, on December the 8th. I remember listening to the speech right here. And or the declaration of war. So I had to go to work Monday night. So that Sunday, that Monday, I headed back to Middletown. A couple of the fellows here had cars. We'd come home practically every weekend, you know, because we lived in a one-room house. Petey and I had the same bedroom. He would use it in the daytime, and I would use it in the daytime. He would use it at night, you know, so it was cheaper that way too, you know. So we weren't making that much money, but really.
And that's 50, 60 miles away?
Harrisburg, no, it's 100 miles, 90, 100 miles, yeah. It's, Harrisburg's about 80, 90, 85 miles, and then Middletown's about 7 or 8, 10 miles south along the Susquehanna. And we would have to go from Harrisburg to Middletown, but there was rides, you know, people had cars. And when war was declared, I went to work Monday night, and they told us all to meet in the hangar, you know. And I remember there were steps of some captain got up and he started explaining about all the damage that was done at Hickam Field. You know, the planes were damaged and all that, and they don't have too much information, but he said are looking for some people to go to Hickam Field on a volunteer basis to work on some planes. That's all he said. Well, the whole, there must have been about 200 people there on the shift, and somebody in the back said, "I'll go," you know, and beam me. I was young and all that. I was up in front, and kind of, he looked at me right in the eye, and he said, "You'll go, won't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll go," just like that. I never thought about it, you know. So they got about 18 guys, 18 volunteers, and we went back to work and all that. I'd never heard another thing about it. When I did get back to my job, and then John Correll was my foreman, he said, "George, what do you want to do that for?" I said, "John, they're not going to take me." I said, "I don't know anything." I said, "They're going to take people who know something about airplanes, you know." So I never heard anything about them. It was December, the 8th came, Christmas came, New Year's came. No one heard anything. You know, it was just a dead silence. So finally, I was on a night shift again, and I was in the men's room, and I was just got to work, and I heard my name being called, and I came out, and they said, "What do you want?" They said, "You're wanted up at headquarters." And I went up to headquarters, and they said that 2 days, not the next day, but the following day, a plane's going to take us out to California. So I said, "Gee," and they told me to be there the next day to get some shots. And I said, "Well, I can't." I said, "I have all these clothes and all that." I said, "How am I going to get all my clothes home from Harrisburg back to Lansford, you know?" So they said, "Well, what you could do is you could take your clothes, and then when we get on the plane," it was a military plane, it was an old DC-6 that had it didn't have seats, it just had like rows of, like a bench along each side, and that's where you just sat on. And they said, we'll take a DC-6 out, and he said, "Before you get on the plane," he said, "you could get the shots." And I said, "Well, that's better, you know." So I immediately left work, and I came back to Harrisburg, got a little sleep, and got up early, and took a bus from Harrisburg to Pottsville, and took another bus from Pottsville to Lansford. Got in here about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. My mother was surprised. She said, "What are you home for?" And I told her, you know, and of course she started to cry, this and that and everything else. I said, "Well," I said, "all I had to do was sign up for," they asked us to sign up for a year. I said, "After a year, they'll send us back." I said, "It's only going to be for a year, you know." And I said, "I'll be back in a year." And in those days, the little we knew about the Japanese and all that, we figured, hey, this is going to last a few months, and it's going to be all over with. We're going to be back, and that would be it. So my father, we waited around here a while, and when finally she calmed down a little bit, and then she was making supper, and she said, "You're going to eat?" I said, "Yeah, I'll eat." Frank was living next door, and he said, "I'll take you back." He said, "I'll borrow my father's car, and we'll all take you back to Harrisburg." So we waited for my father. We waited for him. I waited for him. And he never showed up. So finally I went up to Canucks. And he was surprised to see me. So he said, "Give him a beer, you know," told the bartender. I had a beer and all that. And I told him what's happened. And he came home. And he had a pretty good load on, you know. He didn't know what. And then Frank said he wanted to go to Harrisburg.
Is Frank your sister's husband?
Frankie Schulich. I mentioned him before.
Margaret's husband.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. He borrowed the car, and we went to Harrisburg and all. They let me off and all that. And the next morning, I went down to Middletown. They gave me the shots. And at that time, there were 18 of us and all that. We got the shots. The other people had gotten the day before. For some reason, one of the shots they gave us was a yellow fever shot, was contaminated, you know. Well, we got on the plane, the engines wouldn't start, you know. This was January, right after New Year. Wouldn't start. We got off the plane, went into the hangar, they worked on it a while, and they start the engine, then the engines quit. And I thought, "Oh, brother, this is a good start, you know." So finally they got the plane going, and we get down. We were going to go down almost to New Orleans. They were going to go down south and then spend a night there and then go cross country. The southern road kind of was, you know, I think it was weather. We get down, we ran into a very vicious storm over Tennessee and all that, really bad. And in the meantime, the 18 of us, they all were getting sick. Everybody was throwing up. You know, everything. I mean, it was a mess. I was the only one that wasn't sick. I couldn't believe it. You know, they were really bad. Some were worse than others. You know, they were bent over and all that. So finally they decided, well, hey, we're going to land in Maxwell Air Base outside of Birmingham, Alabama. We landed there. It was raining very hard. We ran off the runway into a mud puddle and all that. And we got out of the plane. We were knee-deep in mud, you know. Finally, we got back to the thing. And then they put all the other people into an infirmary because they were real sick. I was the only one standing. But the next day, I got it. It was, took a day to... Turned out, we never knew what it was. It turned out we were had hepatitis B, you know, and then I never did anything for it, too, and I suffered with that thing, I guess, practically all my time I was out there. I never really felt good after that, and then combination of other things, you know, like malaria and dengue fever, I was a mess, you know, at times, but I found out about it finally. I was, when I came out of the service years back, I was reading one of the journals, one of the books or something like that, and they mentioned how they were looking for people who had gotten these shots, and then you're talking like 15 years later or something, who had gotten these shots, would they contact the veterans and all that, you know? So I went up there, and then they started checking me, and it was still there a little bit, you know, but I eventually got rid of it, you know.
Goodness. Yeah. So it's really just low-grade kind of infection or something.
Well, hepatitis B, yeah. You know, yeah. Well, what happens is a lot of them were so bad, you know, even the original, the 18, they were so bad, they had to send them back to the States, too. You know, they were so sick. Eventually, it attacks the liver, you know. So they made all kind of tests, liver tests and all that stuff. That's how I got to, we landed in Birmingham, Alabama. And after a few days, when people picked up a little, we took off and we landed at Moffett Air Base outside of San Francisco. It was a small air base that was run by, the Air Force had it, you know. We were there about 2 weeks or something. I lived in tents, rained practically every day. And one morning, the night before, they told us that we were going to board a ship in San Francisco, and it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. They got us awake. We just left everything there, the mattresses and all the bunks and everything, and took what clothes we had on us, a suitcase, a bag, and that was it. It was still dark when we got to San Francisco, and like I said, it was pouring rain, and the ship had just come down. It was called the USS Grant. It had just come down from Alaska with dependents of people in Alaska, and they were taking them out of Alaska and bringing them back to the States. And they must have had a rough journey, too, because the place was just full of vomit, you know. I mean, and they had no time to clean it up, and it just smelled to high heaven. And we got down into our bunks and all that, and you couldn't stand it. You know, you had to just get out of the hold, you know, and I could remember... The dawn broke, and I remember going underneath the Golden Gate, and all that. That's how we set sail for Hawaii, for Hickam Field.
So you are at this point going to be a civilian employee.
I was a civilian
of the Air Force.
I was a civilian. I had nothing. I had no. The only thing, it's just like Toby Hannon now. People working for
you were going to be something like a airplane mechanic.
I didn't know what I was going to do. No, I didn't know what I was going to do, really. I was just doing the basic things in, what can you learn in 7 months, you know, not much. And it took us 7 days to get from San Francisco to Hawaii. I would always stay up on deck. And it was kind of cold and all, and I remember I still had my CC jacket. It was a 3/4 length well, a little, not three-quarter length, just between the, a little bigger than a suit coat, but it was pretty heavy. And I remember wearing that thing, you know. And they gave us life jackets, of course, first thing and all that. So I would always stay up on deck. I would sleep on deck. I figured, the heck with it. I'm going to stay. It was an old ship. It was, the USS Grant was confiscated by the United States from the Germans. It was actually, it was the yacht of the Kaiser. It was a huge ship, but it was, you know, it had the brass railings, and it was, well, this was, you're talking 1940-42, and World War One was over, say, 1918. You can imagine how old this ship was, you know, and it creaked. I'm telling you, it was like a haunted castle, and, you know, everything. But it was kind of, you still had some of the brass railings and the carpeting, you know, in the dining room and things like that, you know. So we ate with the officers, you know. We had troops on ship also, you know, GIs. In fact, it was the first convoy to leave San Francisco after the war for the Pacific.
About how many people were in this?
On the ship.
On the ship, and were there other ships with
it? Oh, yes. Yeah, we had two destroyers, a cruiser, a freighter, and our ship, the troop ship. And we had GIs, you know, enlisted men also. They had their own quarters and all. We more or less stayed with the officers and all. We ate with them and all that. And they had their own mess hall, more or less. They ate standing up, really. Well, anyway, it took us 7 days to get there, and I can remember watching the sun and all that. And sometimes you would be going west, other times the sun would be off to the left or something like that. You know, they were zigzagging and all that. And it was about six days later. It was a Friday then. We went on Thursday. The following Friday, it was at night and all that, and they chased us all off on deck, and they said, you have to go below, you know. Of course, you didn't ask questions. You went below, you know, and we got underneath. We got down below in a hold of the ship, and all of a sudden, the engines quit, you know, stopped and all that. And then the depth charges started to go. Yeah, the cruiser come back. Evidently, the Japanese had been following us all the way with submarines, you know, and they had been following us, so they decided, well, we're going to land. It was a Sunday, probably like Sunday. We did land on a Sunday, and this was Friday night. They figured if they're going to do it now. So the cruiser had come back, and the destroyer had come back, and they tried to get the submarines and all that. So they started dropping the depth charge, and it was very quiet. And they were told no one could make a noise, and you could hear this whimpering, you know, and crying, you know, people breaking down, you know, because it lasted a long time. You're almost expecting something to go through the ship, you know, a torpedo or something. Well, finally, after a while, the engine started up again, and we were on our way. I figured, well, that's a good sign, you know. But they never would allow us up on deck again. Well, when the first thing in the morning, I got up, I went up on deck, and I was one of the crewmen, and I said, what was going on last night? He said, oh, well, he said, you know, the Japanese, they were trying to get these submarines, they were after that, the freighter. And they never did get it, you know. So what was on the freighter, which we didn't know, they had B-26 bombers in crates, and that's what they were sending us out there to put these bombers together. We never knew it and all that. I can remember landing. We didn't land in Pearl Harbor. We landed at a place, Little Bay, Kaneohe Base. It's a little south of, between Honolulu and Pearl Harbor. And we got off there, and they took us by trucks. No, a train. We got on the train. And I can remember going by the Hickam Field in Pearl Harbor. And then it dawned on me of the devastation. Up until that time, it was like a lark, you know. You were going to a picnic or something like that. Then it dawned on me, you know. Well, even before that, you know, with the Japanese summer. But when I saw the damage, and it was, and that's how I got to Hawaii. to Hickam Field as a civilian, supposed to be for 1 year, to work on these planes. We worked practically day and night on these planes, you know, on different shifts and putting these together. The B-26 was a Martin, they called it the Martin Marauder, was a very hot ship, had a Davis wing, wasn't really fully tested, but we didn't have anything in those days, the early part of the war. We were rock bottom, you know, rock bottom. These were built in Baltimore, down at the Martin plant in Baltimore, and evidently it took them that time to crate them and everything else, the engines, the wings, the fuselage and everything else, and that was our job, to put these things together.
I mean, among other things, did those planes not have the range?
No, they did.
They couldn't fly from San Francisco to Pearl Harbor.
Oh, no, they had no, that's why they had to, that's why they were in crates, yeah. We lost quite a bit of them. I lost one of my best friends. We had to check the planes out, you know. One day it was his turn to go up and all that, check it out. And the channel of Pearl Harbor just was just on the like the north side, west side of Pearl Harbor, and you had to go over the channel, or more or less, when you took off at Hickam Field, to go over the channel. And he just got over the channel, and the thing just dove right into the channel, you know. So a fellow named Bill, and he didn't last long. He wasn't there long. A couple months, and he was finished. Yeah.
So you weren't a pilot, though. So
No.
That wasn't part of your.
No. Actually, I started. The main thing I started to do then, I got. Well, after we got through with the B-26s and all that, and put those together and all that, then it was time. The Battle of Midway was starting to take place. The Battle of Midway is kind of a turning point of World War II. The United States had intercepted the Japanese code or something like that, and they knew that the Japanese were sending some planes to re-attack Hawaii, you know, at Midway, first through Midway. And then Hawaii, they thought they made a mistake on December the 7th. They should have landed troops or come with a bigger force. This way they left the place intact, you know, more or less. Not intact, but it's still in our possession. And they had intercepted, from what I could get, this I learned later on, they had intercepted some messages and all that. The Japanese were building this big fleet, and carriers and all that were sending it to... with troops and all that, and they were going to land on, or try to land on one of the islands. Well, they had, the United States in the meantime had sent out counterintelligence messages, lured the Japanese to Midway. They had sent a message that they were sending them to like Wake Island or one of the islands south of the Pacific, and they thought, the Japanese thought, all the ships were going down south. In the meantime, they were congregating them all around Midway. And we were put on, when the battle started and all that, we had to take all our engines and stuff, or parts, or radio parts, that, you know, communication parts. We had to load them in trucks and all that, and take them up into the mountains, you know, up in the pineapple fields and warehouses, and store them there.
So they wouldn't be a target.
Yeah. So that we would have, you know, so we loaded them up there, and then we never went back. We stayed at a little place called Hickam Housing. It was a little group of houses that the government had made for workers at Hickam Field, and that's where we stayed as civilians. But many days we would just, you know, stay right in the hangar, sleep in the hangar or something like that. And then they told us to go back to the hangar and to ultimately prepare to go to Midway. And we were waiting. Finally, we got word and said that not to bother going home, that the battle was more or less over. And you know, but it was quite of an experience right off, you know. And